Hey there, and welcome to the 4-Hour City Podcast. I'm Daryl Crouch, your host, and this podcast exists to help you and your church make disciples of Jesus and advance His kingdom by serving the common good in your own community. Today's episode is sponsored by Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Southeastern desires nothing more than to serve the local church and fulfill the Great Commission. Located in the heart of Wake Forest, North Carolina, Southeastern offers 40 degrees from certificate to PhD using multiple delivery formats. For more information or to apply, visit sebts.edu. Wherever you're going, Southeastern can help you get there. Well, I'm happy to introduce to you on today's episode, Godfrey Hubert. He is the pastor of Foundry Church in Houston, Texas. He's been doing that since 1984. During his tenure there, the congregation has grown from 200 to over 5,000 members with two campuses and four venues. They were making an incredible impact in Northwest Houston. But in 2011, Godfrey founded and funded PsyHope, a 501c3 committed to making life better for kids in the Cypress-Fairbanks Independent School District. Many of those are economically, relationally, spiritually at risk. And this nonprofit called PsyHope has made a tremendous impact in the community. They've engaged their neighbors in a way that makes a difference. So I'm really excited to introduce you to Godfrey and let you hear his story. Perhaps you can be reminded that impact and community engagement really is possible in your community as well. So listen in. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Well, I'm here with Godfrey Hubert on the 4-Hour City Podcast. Godfrey is the pastor of Foundry Church in Houston, Texas, really since 1984. And Godfrey, it's great to have you on the 4-Hour City Podcast today.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, tell us a little bit about, before we get into the meat of this interview, just a little bit about you and your family and what you're doing there in Houston.
Well, I'm an immigrant. Missionary kid also. My parents were German Mennonites. They immigrated from Soviet Union back in 29. My grandparents did. Ended up as refugees in Brazil. And then eventually my dad went into mission work. Then we transferred to Quito, Ecuador, where they worked with HCJB Broadcasting, Christian Broadcasting. And at age 18, he put $90 in my pocket and said, "Go to America, son, and find a college." So went to Asbury College where I could play soccer, ended up at Asbury Seminary, and now I'm in Houston. I've been here 33 years pastoring the Foundry Church.
That's wonderful. I appreciate you joining us today and just taking some time out. I know we're on the heels of our Christmas break around here, and so people are just starting to get back into things. So I don't know when this will air, but I appreciate you taking some time this morning.
Well, it's a good time for me, and I'm always excited to talk about what we can do for our city.
Yeah. Well, you founded an organization called PsyHope back in 2010, 2011. Tell us what PsyHope is about, who you are and what you do, and just give us some insight into what you're doing there.
Well, it was back, and by the way, I see it's cold outside your window. I'm sitting outside.
Well, I didn't want to bring that up, but yeah, a little jealousy going on.
Yeah, I'm going to go split wood and do some hog hunting in a bit.
Sounds great.
Back in 2010, I went on a sabbatical to Kauai, house sat for 4 months, and was going to ask my staff each to give me one book I would read. And I never got past the first one, Reggie McNeil's The Present Future. And I'd been feeling some unrest in regard to the direction of the church in North America. And he confirmed my feelings. And so I called him, got involved with the Missional Renaissance with him and Reggie and Eric Swanson. And out of it, PsyHope was born. We looked at all the silos and in our community and realized that we live in an area that is defined by the school district. We're not incorporated. We're in the county, Harris County, northwest of Houston. And what we realize is that people live here for the school district, and that's all we're known for. It's called Sci-Fair, and if we're incorporated, we'd be the size of Indianapolis by population.
Wow.
15th largest city in the country if we were incorporated. Mm-hmm. And so we realized that since the school district is the driver in this area, our mission should be for the kids in our school district. It's the third largest school district in Texas, but the largest suburban school district in the country. We have 117,000 students, 12 high schools. We're at about 90 total schools in our district. And so, we decided to forego some 20 foreign mission projects we had, and almost that many local mission. We were nickel and diming everybody to death. And we decided to stop filling potholes and just start building a highway instead. So we focus entirely on making life better for the kids in Cyfair who are economically, spiritually, and relationally at risk.
Well, that's awesome. We understand, I think, a little bit what economically at risk means. Can you talk about relationally and spiritually at risk and what that looks like, how you define that?
Well, the economy determines what kind of risk you're under. The more impoverished population, as we work with them and through Sci-Hope, we find, they may have a parent that, either it's unemployment, in severe cases, a parent that may be incarcerated. There may be physical abuse and those kinds of things, hunger. And then more affluent homes, relationally at risk, you know what that means, as parents bind their kids' happiness, and that never works. And kids are miserable, and the suicide ideation is pretty high in our more affluent schools. And then spiritually, we all know what that means, the spiritual at risk.
Yeah.
And so what we want to do is not only deal with the economically impoverished, but really all kids, because we're all impoverished in one way or another.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I appreciate you saying that out loud, because it really is true that there's brokenness is a universal problem. And we have a real great opportunity if we'll take advantage of it to meet some people where they are. Well, then let's talk about that. It's a fairly broad, economically, relationally, and spiritually at risk. That's a broad goal and vision. What are some practical things that y'all have been able to incorporate that have helped to make a difference?
Well, we started off opening a couple of Hope Centers. We have three now. These are in trailer park and apartment buildings. Bought a trailer. We have a couple of apartments we're renting, and it's after school homework help, life skill classes, and so on. They're run by college interns, some high school interns, and very youthful in our outreach. And so they all serve right now nine Title I schools. So those are strategically placed, and we want to increase those. Next, we realized that there are a lot of kids that are also going hungry over the weekends. We did an Easter egg hunt for one of the schools. We'd already adopted two elementary schools, and we did an Easter egg hunt for one of them. And since I'm from Latin America, I know Spanish, but nobody suspects it. And I was listening to two moms talking after the Easter egg hunt, and one said, "So what are you going to feed your kids for lunch today?" And she said, "Well, I don't know, but at least they have candy, so they won't complain."
Wow.
So we find that out of the 50% of the 117,000 students we have in our school district, 50% of them are, as we say, at risk. That means they qualify for reduced or free lunches. Now, it also includes breakfast. Now, what we've also learned is 10% of those on free lunches, they're not eating on weekends either. These parents are making barely $15,000 a year, working 2-3 jobs, getting paid minimum wage. And so some of these kids are not eating. Some of them only have one parent. So we started the backpack program. We thought this was going to be the sum total of what Sci-Hope did, but we were able to partner with the Houston's food bank. And so we could grow it a lot larger and focus more attention elsewhere as well. So right now we're in almost 70 schools with a backpack program, feeding 1,600 every weekend. through that. And I love the story of one of our kids. We were worried initially, you know, about stigma and so on. And so we, when we mentioned it to the school officials, they said, got to tell you a story. This one fifth grader who never spoke unless spoken to, and then only with grunts, was very embittered, sullen child. And the school, the counselor thought, but this child may be hungry. So she called him in and suggested he take the paperwork home for his mother to sign if they need it. And he said, what is it? And she, when she explained the backpack program, he said, why does anybody want to help me? Nobody's ever helped me. Mm-hmm. And he was convinced to take it home, and his mother signed it. And he brought it back the next week. And he said, so where am I supposed to get this backpack? And the counselor said, on Friday, you know, you'll go, as soon as school's out, you go to the library and you look for number 2 backpack, because that's your number. We didn't want to put the kids' names on it. Mm-hmm. And so on Friday, when he walked into the library, the librarian said he just broke out in the biggest smile. And he went home. And on Monday, he came back with a white T-shirt on, in which he had written the big number 2.
That is awesome.
And the teacher said his attitude had already changed.
Yeah.
So that's that was the second thing we got into. And also understanding there's a relational impoverishment that goes on as well. And that happens not just in economically. Sometimes it's more prevalent in high-income families where their relationships are poor and not deep. And so we started a counseling center. We now have 18 full-time counselors working with children and their families to help them deal with the issues of life, whether it's bullying or whatever.
Yeah.
We also want to give kids an opportunity to get to know Jesus. So we started Camp Lemonade. We named it that because our own children in our church were starting lemonade stands to help other kids go to camp. So we have contracted with a Christian camp, and we send these kids to camp every summer. On top of that, we wanted them to have opportunities that you wouldn't have. I know it's getting long, but it's a laundry list of opportunities God has given us.
Yeah.
We started Durker's Chance. Larry Durker was a pitcher for the Astros, no-hitter one time, and a manager. He's in my church, and so he lent us his name for the organization to leverage his human influence. So we started Durker's Champs, a sports program, so that low-income kids can have a league of their own. They're already so far behind, they can't catch up. You know, when you're 10 years old and picking up a glove for the first time, you're not going to do well in a competitive league. So we have a whole league, a baseball league for them. We have Divine Virtuosos, a music initiative for low-income kids, so they can, we are starting to collect musical instruments, having them refurbished, and then make them available at very low cost to families so their kids can be in music programs. We sponsor music camps. And then we realized there was a problem with high school kids. We didn't know how to reach them. And we found a solution through a mentoring program called Ambassadors of Compassion. David Hanna and his son Rick founded it. Spencer Tillman's very involved in it. And so we brought this mentoring program, which really deals with the acronym of LIFE, Labor, Influence, Forgiveness, and Experience. And it works through these kids who are most likely to drop out of school, dealing with their problems, learning how to work hard, and how to bring the right influences into their lives. And then we provide them with experiences that will enrich their lives and give them a little footing. So we're now in 6 high schools with that program. So I think that's pretty close to what we do as I Hope. We did start a separate 501c3 with it and launched it because it needed to be community-wide, not merely a church program. And so it has a separate board, and it is it has its own entity.
Yeah. I want to ask you about that and circle back about that in just a moment. But I know earlier, before we started recording, you were pretty excited about some initiatives in disaster relief. Can you talk to us about that and let us kind of a little inside information on that?
Well, as you know, Harvey hit.
Yeah.
And it would be the equivalent of every home in Utah being flooded. Mm-hmm. We have over 850,000 FEMA claims in the state of Texas alone. Yeah. It was huge. The you know, when you get 50 inches of water, there are places in Houston that were had so much water on top of it that sank 11 inches. But so we realized that, you know, we needed to do something. So we consulted with Austin Disaster Recovery Network, and they were gracious to give us a crash course on long-term recovery, gave us all of their materials with a real kingdom mentality. And we came back, and within a week, we were members of VOAD, which oversees all the volunteer work in regard to this disaster, members of the Harris County Disaster Committee, United Way Disaster Committee, and Red Cross. I mean, we threw up the dominoes that landed upright, but we were able in 2 months to get geared up, and we're now the largest disaster recovery network in Harris County, working with other organizations as well. And we're, you know, as you know, churches are great at crisis. You know, when a house gets flooded, as they often do here, we know how to muck and gut, you know, get a house. We don't know what to do after that. How do you get kids back into their homes as quickly as possible? Because if they don't qualify for a loan from FEMA and they don't have insurance, it may be 5-6 years before their funding comes up.
Yeah.
And so we need to get them back in their houses, playing with their friends, going to their own schools, their own churches. And so creating temporary temporary conditions in their homes to live in. And then doing the case management, which is massive. Churches don't appreciate the kind of case management it takes. And we've learned very quickly, one house that a church rushed to sheetrock, it already has to be gutted because they didn't dry it out properly.
Yeah.
And so now we got to rip out all the sheetrock and repair what a church wanted to do because they thought we were not doing it. But you got to make sure they own their house, they're current on their payment. The foundation is not suspect, that that all the mold mitigation has been done, and FEMA is not scheduling to destroy that home, or that it's not a rental. Churches have found out, they go in with a good heart and somebody feeds them a line. They go in, they repair a home, and then find out that, oh, that was a rental unit.
Yeah. Belonged
to somebody else. And they didn't even get the owner's permission to do it.
Right.
So the case management is huge. And we're hiring caseworkers and using volunteers, which is unusual for organizations. But one caseworker can only work 35 to 50 cases.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about in our area, Northwest Harris County, we're going to have about 8,000 homes to repair. It tells you how many case managers we need. And then we have the long-term construction, the rebuilding, and then after that, the mitigation and all of that. So that's what we're doing. We're covering all the facets of recovery and creating a blueprint that can be used elsewhere.
Yeah, I love it. And I think it's so important that you mentioned that not only being there in a crisis, but being there over the long haul and creating a systemic change in the community requires a constant presence. And the things that you've described are more than a menu, although they are a menu of opportunities for serving and for making a difference, but they really represent different segments of your community and in terms of age and economic status and so on. And so I appreciate that. Well, let's talk about the nonprofit and what that looks like from an organizational standpoint. I know that some of us that are listening, the scope of your Sci-Hope's work is pretty phenomenal. And you can't do everything in a day, and you can't, the needs are different in every community, and how you organize around those are different in every community. But can you talk to us a little bit about the organizational structure and just how you've mobilized a number of people that you have in order to have this sustainable presence in your community?
Well, let me quickly just say a word about the Disaster Recovery Network. You know, they say fools rush in, but also I think not just fools, but I also think smart people know when to rush in. And we did. And we were, you know, we were told by the Harris County Disaster Committee, it took us 2 months to do, he said, what should take us 2 years. And timing is everything. The question that our board asked, well, should we wait and make sure funding and everything is there? And I said, well, right now our church has given $75,000, got some more. Let's hire the personnel and then use FEMA money and and also all the grant money to do the actual repairs. And so we created a movement, and that's what I want to keep it as a movement as long as possible, because if you start by focusing on the organization, it becomes a self-serving organization, as most charities in this country are. And I hear somebody mowing out there. If I need to go inside, let me know.
No, it's okay.
Sound is bad. Now, in regard to I Hope, we also wanted to make sure that it remains a movement, not a organization. And so we have been very conscientious to carry out sound business practices without encumbering the movement with bureaucracy and undue restrictions. I forgot who it was up in Minnesota or Wisconsin, there, a professor who talked about the three stages of every organization. One is spiritual, the spirit stage, the body stage, and the casket stage.
Yeah.
And what we want to do is make sure we stay in the spirit stage, because once the body takes over, it starts limiting. And we have to fight all the time that we are here to build a kingdom, not to build our organization.
Yeah, that's so important. And I think some of us who we want to be good stewards, we tend to circle the wagons and try to control certain things that really aren't ours to control, and we miss the kingdom.
Exactly. And so when we started with I Hope, this may sound unusual, but as a senior pastor, I know how senior pastors operate. I know what motivates us, and it's always, anytime anybody approached me, it was, well, what's my thought behind, you know, in the back of my mind was, what's in it for me and my church, and what role am I going to play in it? So knowing myself, knowing I'm not unique, I said, we can't build anything if we start with senior pastors. So we went to the community leaders. We went first to the school district and developed a really great working relationship with them. Told them they're the professionals. We're just the wind beneath their wings. And we're there to protect and encourage them and to help any way we can to fill in the gaps for them. So we built some of the key school district leadership got on our board right up front. And then we started looking for the key community leaders and business leaders who would come around. And you know, all of those actually are church members somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. Once they got involved, they started talking to their pastors about, hey, we need to be involved in this. And so we were able to build. And one of the reasons why it took off so fast, because we were named the second, our second year, or third year, we were named a nonprofit of the year. And because it grew so rapidly, is that when Foundry said, this is what's going to be our mission, this is our highway we're going to build, we decided to, we were in the middle of a capital funds drive at the time for our second campus. And so we decided that the first million we raised would go to SciHope.
Yeah.
And the rest would go to the second campus, and only 500,000 remain at the main, at the first campus to do some repairs. So the church was very kingdom minded in the decisions we made, that very little of the money that we raised and was given came back to us. But had we not given that first million to Sci Hope, we would have struggled.
Yeah.
It gave us the traction we needed.
Yeah. I love it. Well, as I could talk to you all day about this, I just think it's exciting to see a church that could do a lot of different things. You had a lot of options. You made your city transformation a real commitment, not just on a menu of things, but really made it central to your mission. And I think that that should be encouragement to all of us who are wanting to impact our city, particularly make a gospel impact, that we can do that by just asking good questions and building good relationships with leaders throughout our city.
Well, and not just asking the good questions, but believing the answers.
Yeah.
Because I think we all have the answers. We don't always want to live by them. My issue, my personal issue and journey of faith was I'd originally been called to mission work, and my oldest son is autistic, and we couldn't go. And so I ended up in the church pastoring. By default, in a sense, I know it was God's leading me that way through circumstances, but I woke up in 2010, realized I'd become a senior pastor rather than missionary. And what I realized is senior pastors ought to be the chief missionary in every church, and not the, and I think one of the worst analogies we have brought. See, we keep bringing the kingdom of the world into the church. It has become a service industry, as Reggie McNeil likes to say. And at the very time when we decided to look for best practices in the outside world, outside the church, it was when Disney was coming into its own in the 70s, and we ended up bringing the service industry into the church, and we've created a monster with an insatiable appetite that is always going to say, what have you done for me lately? And so, you know, this business that the pastor is a chief executive officer of the church, that's true. But if that's what we focus on, I think the church, the kingdom is, it may run a good church, but it's not going to build a kingdom.
Yeah.
We need to be missionaries.
Oh, Godfrey, that is a great place to end this conversation. Final word of encouragement to us, and that we should be the chief missionaries in our church, but also in our city, in our community, and lead the way in city transformation. Thanks for the example that you've set and the pace that you've set for the rest of us.
Well, it's my honor. It's my privilege. And by the way, choosing the right way is not the easiest way.
Yeah, there's some challenges ahead, right?
It makes life and ministry more difficult, because we've created this enormous bureaucracy around the American church that we think takes to build a spiritual kingdom. And so we'll have to deal with that in generations to come.
Well, I'd love to have you on the podcast again in the near future and follow up with that and drill down a little bit deeper into what that takes.
Hey, I enjoyed getting to know you, and I appreciate what you're doing up there.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, what a great time with Godfrey Hubert, just hearing how God is using PsyHope in his community there in Northwest Houston. It really is making a difference. At one point, I said something about asking good questions, and he responded by and believing the answers. I think it's really important, as we want to serve our community, that we not only ask good questions, but that we are willing to listen and respond to what people actually say and how people actually feel and what people are actually experiencing. And city transformation happens when we really do listen to the answers to our questions. And so PsyHope is a great example of that. You can visit forourcity.us to see the show notes from today's episode. You'll see a link to their website, psy-hope.org, and get all kinds of information, see what God is doing there. And as a reminder that you can really make a difference in your community as well. Also at forourcity.us, you can subscribe to the podcast. You can do that at iTunes or Stitcher as well. And I encourage you to do that. Tell your friends about For Our City and the podcast and what we're doing. And I look forward to being with you next time as we live for our city.